This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this episode of In Our Time. There's a reading list to go with it on our website, and you can get news about our programmes if you follow us on Twitter at BBC In Our Time. I hope you enjoyed the programmes. Hello. According to Plato, 4th century BC, there was once a great island of Atlantis out to the west beyond the known world of the Mediterranean. He tells his story across two of his works, the Timaeus and the Critias, along with proof that his story is absolutely reliable and clues that it's not at all reliable. For Plato, Atlantis is a way to explore what an ideal republic really is and whether Athens could be or ever was one. Yet somehow he also inspired generations of explorers to scour the oceans and distant lands in the hope of finding this lost world. With me to discuss Plato's Atlantis are Edith Hall, Professor of Classics at Durham University, Christopher Gill, Emeritus Professor of Ancient Thought at the University of Exeter, and Angie Hobbs, Professor of the Public Understanding of Philosophy at the University of Sheffield. Angie, what is the setting for Plato's telling of the Atlantis story?
Yes, so we've got four characters. We've got Socrates, Timaeus, Critias and Hippocrates. And the day before, they've been discussing certain elements of the ideally just state as outlined in Plato's Republic books 2 to 5. And they've had that discussion. And Socrates says, I want to see our ideally just state in action. I want to see how it stands up to the stresses of war. I want to see if our education system, if the virtues that we've instilled will help it. And Critias, a friend of Socrates, says, well, funny you should mention that, because after our conversation yesterday as we were going home, I thought, do you know what? The ideally just state of that we were discussing reminds me of a story that I heard when I was a very little boy, and I heard it from my grandfather when he was a very old man. And my grandfather said that he'd heard this story from his father, who'd heard it from the great Athenian lawgiver Solon, about this great event that happened 9,000 years before, in which prehistoric Athens, poor, not very powerful, but very virtuous, had taken on the might of the great maritime empire of Atlantis. And though it was comparatively poor and powerless, it had defeated Atlantis through its virtue. And Critias says, if you want to see what your ideally just state looks like when tested in war, let's look at this story of the war between prehistoric Athens and Atlantis.
What are the key features of the ideal republic according to Plato?
Yes, so you've got a separation between the guardian class who rule and the producers who produce all the goods. In the Republic, the guardian class itself is divided into two, philosopher rulers and auxiliaries. We don't get that distinction in the Timaeus. We just get a distinction between guardians and producers. The guardians live an austere communal lifestyle. They are not allowed to possess wealth of any kind.
Communist, really.
Exactly, indeed. And the producers provide them with, you know, all their material needs for at a subsistence level. They're educated in a very careful way. So you've got this extremely austere lifestyle. And those are the features that the Timaeus picks up on.
Edith, Edith Hall, how does Critias describe Atlantis?
Atlantis is a very enormous island that's lying in the Atlantic, extending near the coast of Africa from the southern Sahara all the way up to Cadiz. It starts out as just one very, very large island with a mountain in the middle. Poseidon falls in love with Clytie, who is this human girl on the mountain. And because he doesn't want anyone else to ever get to have sex with her, he puts in three canals of water to divide the mountain in the middle from any of the other bits of land so that nobody can get to her. But in time, when he's had his five sets of twins and the kings of they turn into kings, all this engineering takes place. They form bridges across these canals. They make harbours. They make docks. They even build an enormous wall with little houses on that extends all the way from the mountain to the sea. At the very centre is the great temple of Poseidon, who's been booted out of Athens. Poseidon is no longer the co-tutelary god of Athens, that's Hephaestus. He has the most magnificent temple with Clytie, where he's shown with 100 nereids and 6 galloping horses, and that is entirely made of silver with golden turrets. There are thousands of golden statues. The central part of the island has this massive race course going all the way around it. There are bulls roaming all around the central island, but there is incredible noise. This is something that he makes a great point of because of the fleet. There's an incredible racket going on with the cutting down of trees and the building of all of these ships and the maritime trade in the ports.
Chris Gill.
The text of the Critias ends with Zeus about to intervene and to punish the Atlanteans for their excess and imperialism. But we already know at the end of the Timaeus section that there will be a huge earthquake and flood, and that will destroy both the whole of Atlantis, which will be sunk beneath the waves, and also the army of ancient Athens will be destroyed in the same process. So they will go below the earth. They don't ever have to have contact with the sea. So they go below the earth and Atlantis goes below the sea. And that's the end of it.
And Critias, who was he?
Critias is the extremely unreliable narrator of the entire Atlantis story, both the short bit in the Timaeus and then the expanded version in the Critias. The historic Critias is a deeply problematic figure. He was what we would call the most right-wing person in Athens. I mean, he was a radical oligarch. He was related to Plato. He was probably the first cousin of Plato's mother. He's some sort of uncle or cousin. And he was murkily involved in the first great counter-democratic coup of 411. So that's about 20 years before this is written. He then managed to get exiled because of his association with the terrible tyranny that was set up in 411, came back, and once Sparta had conquered Athens in 404, became the nastiest of all the 30 tyrants.
So we've got Athens and we've got Atlantis. So I'm going to turn to you, Chris. The story's said to have been passed down by the Egyptians. We're told Solon was involved, the great lawmaker. What do you make of it?
Well, it's just nonsense, really, as a kind of historical account. But it's a wonderful way of explaining how this extraordinarily ancient story could have been transmitted. So we have the transmission. So as Angie outlined, Critias got it from his grandfather, who got it from his father, who got it from Solon, the 6th century statesman and poet. Solon, in turn, got it from the Egyptians. Now, the Egyptians were very famous for the antiquity of their culture. In this version, they are in a state that was founded 8,000 years ago. And then, by some means that are not clear, they knew about primeval Athens, which was 9,000 years from this event. So that's how the transmission is prevented. Egyptian priests to Solon through to the family. Now, there's a number of very interesting points that come out about that. First of all, obviously, it establishes the pseudo-antiquity of this. And, of course, It's the antiquity is one of the clues to the falseness, because the ancient Greeks had no idea of what happened 9,000 years ago or 8,000 years ago or anything like it. I mean, history for them was contemporary history. That's what Herodotus and Thucydides presented, contemporary history. So that already puts
But Egyptians had history.
Well... they didn't, well...
On the walls even, but they had history,
yes,
up to a point.
Egyptians knew, yes, that's why they used. Of course, they didn't have this history, but they had some history. The other rather interesting feature that comes out of this is, again, relating to this dubious character, Critias. It makes it very much a family business. So it was transmitted down in his family, which, of course, makes, you know, this is an aristocrat. This is someone for whom family is crucial. And it also makes it very much an Athenian story. Now, Socrates hadn't asked for an Athenian story. Socrates had asked for...
When did Socrates...
At the very beginning. I mean, Socrates said, show me the ideal state in action. He didn't say, show me the ideal state in action in Athens. So the shifting of the context to Athens is a move made by Critias. So all these kind of features hang together, I think.
There's one quote we have to get in. When Solon is talking to the Egyptian priests and he's saying, oh, we had this great flood in, you know, we had the Deucalion and Pyrrha. And the Egyptian priest says, oh, Solon, Solon, you Greeks are always children. There is no such thing as an old Greek. You're just born yesterday. You don't know your ancient history. You don't have all our written records. And you're gullible also. But who is Plato writing for? He's writing for Greeks. So he's really being mischievous. He's having such fun with this.
The question arises, Angie, why does he want to take this? Why does Plato want to take up this Atlantis story? What's in it for him?
He wants to look at the ethical and political and theological implications of the story. He wants to show...
Does he believe the story?
Well, he's making nearly all of it up. Well, I personally think, and my colleagues might not agree with me, I personally think there probably are some folklore elements which have influenced this story.
So he believes it enough to want to write about it, either he believes
it... No, he's making nearly all of it up. Right. He thinks that there are ethical and political and theological lessons to be learnt from it. He's interested in the relationship between myth and account, between mythos and logos, and how they interplay and why we need both in a flourishing culture. So there's lots that I think he has an anti-imperialistic message in this, because Atlantis does okay as a rich, powerful maritime empire, so long as it stays.
What's he trying to do with Atlantis?
Here he's got an example of a state which is doing all right so long as it doesn't get too big for its boots. It's when it decides to extend its empire into the east and go beyond Libya into Egypt and try to go beyond Etruria and conquer Greece. That's when the gods get angry, and that's when the virtues of poor but plucky little prehistoric Athens win the day. However, we should note that though virtue can defeat human vice, you're still powerless in the face of the gods, because both virtuous prehistoric Athens and Atlantis, they at a later date, in one terrible day and night, they both get obliterated by earthquake and tsunami. They both disappear.
I think what Plato is trying to do with this whole story, the underlying motive, is a desire not just because he's done the ideal state, that's what we've had in the Republic. What he's interested in here, and it does link again with this idea of fiction, it's putting the ideal into concrete form, into embodied form, into a landscape, into all the physical aspects of a state, its environment. So I think that's what's at the bottom is going on here. It's embodiment, and of course it's very important that this whole story is a kind of, is located within the creation story of the Timaeus, because we have the Timaeus, first of all, which summarizes the story, then this enormous creation story, and then the Critias. And the creation story is all about putting the ideal into concrete form. So I think that's what makes the Atlantis story different, or different at least from the Republic, though perhaps less different from the Laws.
Edith?
I believe that Atlantis represents the contemporary Athenian democracy of the late 5th century. I think that the Atlanteans are sort of one perspective on Athens, and the early Athenians are another. The main reason I say that is that the big difference between the prehistoric Atlanteans and the prehistoric Athenians is actually militarily. The prehistoric Athenians are an inland, he actually managed to make Athens an inland state by saying there'd been a lot of erosion since, with a land infantry army that makes them like the Spartans. They had no ships. They had no sailors. Yeah. The Atlanteans are a massive sea power, what the ancient Greeks called a thalassocracy, right? That means a constitution based on the sea. From that point of view, they're identical to the Periclean Athenian Empire, and it's their seagoing power that makes them fall. But the point about Critias is that he is deeply, deeply associated with being against the sailors of Athens. And I think we need to get this on the table very quickly. So the most radical members of the Athenian democracy lived in the harbour town of Piraeus. Aristotle says they are far more democratic than anybody else because they know they make the money. They're very poor. They've mostly only got one slave maximum each. They're poor but free. And they are the big voting power in the democracy. And Aristotle says that they have this extremely fervent democratic spirit. Now, Critias actually went when he did the coup with the 30 tyrants and staked out Piraeus and took on the navy and was actually killed in Piraeus. He was actually killed there by the then victorious Democrats who reinstated the democracy. Guess where the Republic is set? In the Piraeus. Why do we go down to the Piraeus to think out the navy-free Kallipolis, beautiful city of the Republic? Right. It's all to do with Critias's opposition to the thalassocratic Athenian democracy ruled by working class sailors.
So can we just develop that?
Plato underlines this by giving primeval Athens more land. So there is actually he remodels the landscape of Attica so that the Acropolis, which was relatively small in Plato's day and ours, becomes much bigger. So it becomes a land power in itself. It becomes more fertile. And so that's one major difference, land, from sea to land. The other difference is we've already referred to, is the difference between a democratic state and a quasi-communist state. And the other, of course, difference that would strike anyone immediately is this is an Acropolis with no Parthenon, no statues, no artistry, no culture. Architecture and engineering have been screened out of this Athens, primeval Athens.
Why is he doing it in a story form? Well, for me, myth is really important for Plato because myth speaks to parts of our psyche which are not purely our rational part. It's also going to engage our emotions. It can really resonate with us. The active philosophizing, the active interpretation that's needed to try to decode a myth is a really important philosophical tool. And the Egyptian priest who tells the story to Solon, he says in the Timaeus that myths, that these stories, they can symbolize cosmological processes and historical events. So Plato gives us a clue that we need to be decoding here. So that's really important. And then I think he thinks there are some things which are better understood through story, through myth, and the active reinterpretation of myth through the generations.
Can I just say that I think that he is actually consciously inventing a new genre, which is historical fiction. I think he is inventing the historical novel here. The thing about Plato is whatever you think of his philosophy, and he's got a very, very divided reception, he is a magnificent writer and an incredibly experimental writer. And there are three different ways he goes about trying to explain what the beautiful city is, one in the Republic, one in the Atlantis story, and one in the Laws. He is prepared to use incredible varieties of genres of literature and invent them in order to explore and push at the limits of what philosophical discourse could be. In the Republic, there's also a political answer to what is the actual literary form of this, which is that Socrates tells what he calls a noble lie, a noble fiction. He says that telling fictions for the good of the people, to get them to understand their history is actually a good thing. In that, he talks about...
Is this anywhere near propaganda?
It is absolutely propaganda. Yeah. He says when the guardians of the state need to explain something to the thoroughly unwise, uneducated masses, then telling them a story, even if you know it's not true, can be a very good thing. And I think Critias takes the cue from that and comes up with the biggest noble lie of them all.
You said noble lie. I mean, it's something that's not true. That's the word in the Republic. So it's something that's not true. It might not... Lie's quite strong. It doesn't have to be translated as a lie.
You don't have to translate it as a lie, but you can translate it as a lie, given the actual technical terms to do with pseudo stuff.
Yes, it's a fiction.
In the Greek. But the point is that he has told us in the Republic that we can get everybody to believe that they ought to stay in their own classes, right, and not mingle across classes unless they're unbelievably exceptionally brilliant. And he gives a myth about how you don't want to mix metals or you get corrupt alloys. That's one example. This is Critias picking up on the idea that you can tell something which is completely fictive, I believe, in order to brainwash the people, I would go that far, into believing that they shouldn't be a sea power, and in particular that they shouldn't give the rabble-rousing sailors, as they are absolutely called in the Republic, they're exactly the sort of people you mustn't put on in the theatre because people will imitate them. They're the worst kind of human. You must not have a society where the sailors have that kind of power. And I think this is what the Greeks call an etiological, that's explaining the causes, myth justifying the preference for a land-based power that is not imperialistic over a maritime power that is.
Chris Gill.
I think another way of looking at this might be in terms of his evocation of wars, the evocation of the wars of the 5th century. Because in this story, Athens plays a double role. He replays, as it were, the two great wars of the 5th century, the Persian War and the Peloponnesian War. So Athens plays two roles. First of all, Primeval Athens plays the role...
Primeval being what dates?
Well, this the same one, ancient Athens, 9,000 years ago.
Yeah.
So ancient Athens plays the role, first of all, of Athens in the Persian Wars, standing against the Persians, plucky little Athens at Marathon and Salamis, and doing so with its army at Marathon, which would be crucial for him. And in that sense, it is successful and defeats Atlantis. And that's one of the big contrasts between Athens and Atlantis. But secondly, primeval Athens plays the role of Sparta. There's a kind of, identity switch. And primeval Athens then is more like a land power, more like an army. And Atlantis takes over the role of Athens. Atlantis becomes the quasi-democratic, imperialistic state of the later 5th century. So there's this very, very interesting and complex replaying of the two wars, with Athens having a dual, ancient Athens, that is, having a dual role. And that's another way of communicating the significance of the story in terms of what brings success and failure and what is virtue and not virtue.
So this is steering towards the idea of what is an ideal republic.
Yes, the whole thing is the beginning and the end of it is an ideal republic.
Andrew, you want to come in?
Yes, in your introduction, you talked about the conflicting clues that Plato sows about whether we're meant to believe this or not. And I think that's absolutely crucial because on the one hand, we're told that Solon, the wisest of the seven wise men, once vouched for its truth. Socrates later says the great thing about this is it's not a mythos, it's not a myth, it's an alethinos logos, a true account. As we've already discussed, the chronology works. Plato does always have some respect for Egypt and Egyptian culture throughout his works, so he's a bit ambivalent. So we've got clues that at some level it's true, but also at the same time, there's all sorts of indications that it's not true, that the heavy irony of Critias saying, it's amazing that this prehistoric Athens matches our ideally just state in almost every detail. You know, wouldn't you believe it? The initial Atlantis civilization, it's formed when the sea god Poseidon has a union with the human Clato, and they give birth to five sets of male twins. So that's that divine human intermingling is obviously fictional. If Plato's not making it up, somebody is. So there are all these sort of fictional elements as well. And I think that's absolutely deliberate on Plato's part. I think he wants to keep us guessing. I think he's written a multi-layered story because he doesn't want anybody to know for all time whether it's true or false. Why? Because that keeps the myth alive. It makes it imperative for us to keep interpreting it, to become active philosophizers. And it's a great pedagogic tool. And the ancients, even just after his death, they couldn't agree on whether it was true or false. So he really succeeded.
Most of them thought it was false, didn't they?
But quite a few were.
Yeah, but not. But was a few. The word "few."
Yeah, but Crantor, Strabo, Posidonius, a few thought that it might well be true. So
can we talk about Atlantis? Is this a thought experiment?
I think it is a thought experiment. I think that Critias has taken the idea that we want to find these people in action, and the metaphor that Socrates actually uses is of a tableau vivant. It's actually of actors somehow acting this out. So we've got three different versions, as I mentioned earlier, in Plato of a vision of the ideal republic. In the actual republic, it's in the subjunctive. What if we could make a society like this? In his Laws, we have an old Athenian, usually identified with Socrates, who plans an actual colony. That's not in the subjunctive, that's in the concrete future tense. We will do this. We will make an inland city which has no ships, which has no sailors, and which is going to look like that. That's in the concrete future. In the Atlantis story, we set it 9,000 years in the past.
What
as historical fiction, so it's a past tense. I believe that he is pushing at the limits of what philosophical discourse might look like, but I also think that the role of Critias is absolutely crucial. Socrates himself agreed with most, I believe Socrates himself, certainly Plato, agreed with almost everything that Critias said about the ideal state. But he does not want to go so far as to be the mouthpiece of it. So he puts this person known to be the most radical anti-democrat in the city in it. And there is one absolutely crucial difference between the ideal Athens of 9,000 years ago and the Kallipolis of the Republic, and that is this. The Kallipolis of the Republic is run by philosopher kings.
And queens.
It's run by philosopher monarchs. And a brilliant article by one of Britain's greatest Platonists, Christopher Rowe, said, why isn't the primeval Athens of Atlantis run by philosopher kings? It's actually run by the army. Now, Critias was ahead of the army. So we have Critias making a very different ideal republic that's not run by philosopher kings. And I think Socrates and Plato is forcing the reader to realise that is the one difference. Angie said that Critias says it in almost every detail, this is identical to what you were outlining yesterday. What we all ask is the difference. Boom. It is not run by thinking, trained philosopher kings. It's run by the military.
Yeah, that's really that is very interesting. It is one of the great puzzles of the Atlantis story, what's happened to the philosopher kings. It is strange because Plato still clearly believes in them, because he, in the introduction, he says, well, you, Timaeus and Hermocrates and Critias, you're just the right people to tell this story.
But they're because not. You can buy, they're well, military
well,
men.
I know, but that's what he says. So he hasn't given up the ideal. But you're right. It's not there. It's the Republic, but it stops before you get to the
We've got
the so-called auxiliaries. The auxiliaries are there, but no philosophy rulers. So they've gone. But whether they've quite what the implications of that are really left open. I mean, it could be that he, just wants a law-bound state, as has been suggested, that he ceases to believe in the philosopher ruler and believes in a law-bound state. But that doesn't really work, because when you come to the Laws, we have there something called the Nocturnal Council, who become, at any rate, philosophers. So I think he does, throughout his life, continue to believe in the philosopher king, the philosopher queen. So there is this puzzle with the Atlantis story.
Why do you think he broke it off? It's incomplete, isn't it?
Well, I think I can think of at least three reasons he broke it off.
Okay.
One was because he decided that he didn't, although he had the idea of historical fiction, he didn't actually want to do it. He got a bit fed up with all this. I mean, he breaks it off just as the purely fictional, you know, the full creative element begins. We have Zeus making a speech, and he'd have to make lots more speeches, and he would have to have lots more narrative. He really would have to become a kind of Herodotus, Thucydides, Homer, and he just thought, oh, forget it. You know? I mean, I just can't go through with all this. So he flings the pen down in mid-sentence. It's a really extraordinary ending.
What are the other two?
The other two is that he says, okay, I still want to do what I originally wanted to do, which is to put the ideal into a concrete form and to look at questions of land and sea and the kind of stuff of political life, but I'll do it properly. I'll do it in a philosophical way. And he does it in the Laws. That's what he actually does write at huge length, are the Laws. So I think that's another reason why he flung down the pen. The third reason is that he might have thought, well, hang on, I have really made the main points already at the end of the Critias, because we've got the contrast. We've got the contrast between the two states, primeval Athens and Atlantis. We know the rough outline of the story. We've got, you know, Athens, plucky Athens, is going to defeat Atlantis. We know that Atlantis is going to decline and become corrupt. So we've kind of got it, and we don't really need the rest.
Angie, did Plato tell us his sources of inspiration for going for Atlantis?
Well, what I think, which I may be the only one on this table who thinks this, I think that Plato has inherited some folklore tales, some oral tales. I think that some of these about cities that are destroyed by earthquake and tsunami, and he doesn't just have to inherit the tales. In 373 BCE, Helike in the northern Peloponnese was just wiped out overnight in an earthquake and tsunami, so it's going on. But I think he has inherited some tales which have their roots in Minoan Thera and Crete. Now, Plato didn't know about the Minoan civilization. None of them did at this time, so it wouldn't be conscious. But to me, there are some telling details. We haven't yet really discussed the kind of luxurious gorgeousness and technological sophistication of Atlantis.
Well, because it might not exist.
Well, but it's important to get these details right. So it's full of beautiful gardens and fruit, and there are gymnasia, and there's a horse racing track, and they love pleasure, but also there are some very key details. So the kings, when they meet every fifth and sixth year, the ten kings meet in the temple of Poseidon in the centre of the island, and in that temple bulls roam, and we know that Minoan civilization had a big bull culture. You said, what are Plato's origins? Yeah. And if he's heard folklore tales about this very fabulously technologically advanced civilization, which he wouldn't have called Minoan, but if he's heard any tales and about how it was destroyed, then I think it's very likely you've got the bull culture, you've got the dolphins. They talk about how the towers are built of red, white and black stone on Atlantis. Now, I've been on Santorini, modern Thera, and there are piles of red, white and black stones everywhere. That's still a thing. So I think that might be one of the inspirations, not that Plato would have known that name, but also I think Plato is got an anti-imperialistic message anyway. After the generation of Marathon defeated the Persians, then Athens creates its own empire, and it gets above itself. It acts hubristically.
Edith, I think there are three further sources that he's using that thoroughly imbue it. It is deeply Herodotean. Herodotus has written these great ethnographies and anthropologies, and actually stylistic analysis has shown that this is the most Herodotean passage in all of Plato in terms of the actual language. Secondly, Phaeacia in the Odyssey, the idea of a wonderful land where the fruit and animals and trees and flowing water are there with practically no labour. That is actually a magical world from the most, you know, famous author of all, Homer. Thirdly, the Phoenicians.
Yeah.
The Phoenicians, yes, are the great sea power who, before the ancient Greeks had developed all their triremes, had cracked it. They'd also sailed down the coast of West Africa. They had actually done that, and the Greeks believed that they'd done that, and they had texts that they had done that. So they had gone into the Atlantic in a way that the Greeks never had. In the Republic, the noble lie or the noble fiction is actually called A Little Phoenician Tale. So there's something going on about the Phoenician culture, as well as inherited folk memories of tsunamis, which I absolutely believe, because there's constant tsunamis in the Eastern Mediterranean, even today on a small scale. So there are all those other different sources. What does this mean to Plato's philosophy? Well, it affects every single branch, his whole project, as Angie said earlier. So it's ethical and political. That's one branch of Plato's philosophy. The three great branches are how should we live? That's ethics and politics. What is being? That's ontology. Does this place actually exist or not? If it's in a story, of course it's got some ontological status because we're talking about it. But did it really exist? Ontology, metaphysics, how the gods made the world, did the gods make the world? And the third, of course, most importantly of all in some ways, is epistemology. How do we know things? And by every stage of this story, undermining its plausibility and credibility, even to jokes that old men constantly forget what's happened, right? There are jokes about the bad memory of people throughout Plato, but in particular in this passage. We've got the 1,000 years where it must have been orally transmitted, very carefully put out. There are so many ways it's undermined. So the three great branches of Platonic philosophy, which are ontology, epistemology, and ethics politics, are all richly evidenced in Critias's silly tale.
Chris, how would you?
I think there are three features of the difference between Athens and Atlantis that are important and actually different, perhaps, from other works. The contrast is partly between unity and structured complexity. That's quite an important difference. There's a difference between stability and change. Atlantis it begins in one physical state and it's completely transformed by engineering and mechanical work. So that's a second contrast. And the third contrast is between moderation, or what the Greeks called sophrosyne, and kind of exploitation and what the Greeks call pleonexia, the desire for more. So there are these three very strong contrasts between the states. And I don't think there's, although it relates in a way to what you find in the Republic and Laws, this is the only one in which I think we have those three features. And they're not simply there as ideas, but they're also, as I said before, they're embodied. They're given what Shakespeare called a local habitation and a name, and that's another thing that makes it so different and so distinctive.
Can we, Angie, discuss why this story, which Aristotle and a lot like him said it was a fiction, gathered in power and importance when we came to the Renaissance and 19th century? What attracted people so much to this story? Was it the fairy? Was it the fictional thing, the fairy? What was going on?
Well, in the Renaissance, you've got the discovery of the New World. Yeah. And that, of course, sends people like Thomas More back to this tale, and he develops his own utopia. And that interest continues, but it becomes very dark in the 19th century. Various scholars of Mesoamerica started to argue that the fabulously beautiful and technologically advanced Mayan culture, for instance, couldn't have been created by Mesoamericans. It must have been the Atlanteans who somehow got over and created this. So you've got that sort of racist European supremacy comes in. And it gets darker and darker. In 1882, Ignatius Donnelly writes Atlantis, an Antediluvian World. And he argues that all ancient civilizations basically stem from Atlantis. Again, a very Eurocentric view. In 1888, Madame Blavatsky, she writes The Secret Doctrine, where she puts forward her view that there's a racial eugenics and that the Atlanteans somehow give rise to the Aryans. And then from 1900, a number of German and Austrian scholars really take up on that idea and argue, and they locate Atlantis in the far north of Europe, and they posit a Hyperborean Nordic super race who again are the progenitors of the Aryans, and they distinguish the Atlantean Aryans from the Jewish races. And Himmler and Rosenberg then make this official Nazi doctrine in the 1930s.
Edith Hall, why do you think it travelled so far away from Plato's idea, original idea?
I think that it's a deeply riveting story. The whole idea of the lost world that we might rediscover is something that has engaged every generation since the Renaissance, but it didn't really enter popular culture until the late Regency period, when it's finally translated into European vernaculars. So, for example, a man called Taylor was the first person to translate the two Platonic dialogues into English. So all of a sudden, you start to get popular burlesques on the London stage. You start to get spectacles you can pay to go and see. You start to it enters a much more popular area of culture where it doesn't have these dark overtones that it certainly did with National Socialism. It's simply fun. And that, you know, Jules Verne gets the Nautilus's crew, you know, to come across Atlantis. So it becomes very, very important in all kinds of science fiction writing as a result of that. That leads all the way through to more than 400 films have been made with some relationship to the Atlantis story. And it was very early on in cinema because of the spectacle, because of the great visual detail of the Platonic account. My favourite is actually, if you go to Legoland Denmark, the Billund Legoland, you can actually scuba dive into a huge artificial lagoon. You can scuba dive down to the Lego submerged Atlantis. So on top of the very dark reception that is to do with racism and the superiority of the Aryan race, you've also got a really, I think, delightful popular culture. And I love the fact that when I look at little children looking at all the Atlantis Lego, I love to think that this is Plato. I think, hey, classics for the masses, we've got there.
Really? Well, Chris, can you tell us, we're coming to the end of the programme now, tell us what effect you think on philosophy and on the development of the idea of how a city should be run this had, these two books, Timaeus and Critias, had?
I'm not sure that it has, at that serious level, I'm not sure that it has had that much effect. I think it has a kind of green meaning for us, because the contrast between Athens and Atlantis, it's embodied, it's placed in the land, the landscape. And the contrast between them is very interesting in this respect. In Athens, primeval Athens is the kind of sustainable state, has a steady population, 20,000 of the guardians, no more, no less. It's very moderate. There's no excess. In Atlantis, on the other hand, anything goes. It's expansionist. They're constantly doing engineering, architecture. They're imperialistic. It's all
down
about growth.
All the timber,
yeah,
and they mine all the metals.
Exactly. Yeah. So Atlantis has a big carbon footprint.
Exactly.
So I think, you know, for our age, the Atlantis story is a great green legend.
Well, thank you all very much. Thank you, Edith Hall, Angie Hobbs and Chris Gill, and our studio engineer, Jackie Marjoram. Next week, it's electrons and how their place at the outer reaches of atoms makes them a driver of modernity. Thanks for listening.
And the In Our Time podcast gets some extra time now with a few minutes of bonus material from Melvin and his guests.
I'd love to explore the anti-imperialistic message more, because we've talked about how Atlantis comes a cropper when its imperialistic ambitions become too hubristic and it tries to extend its power further east. We've mentioned how Plato's also thinking about how the generation of Marathon defeat the mighty Persian army in 490 and then again in 480 and 479. So we've talked about that, the dangers of empire building. But I think there's more to it, because after Athenians beat off the Persians and they develop their own empire and they get too big for their boots and they end up in a horrific civil war with Sparta, which they lose horribly. And one of their most hubristic actions in that war was to the expedition to Sicily in 415 to 413, which they lose disastrously. Now, one of the characters in the conversation is Hermocrates, and he's from Syracuse. And actually, that's for me, that's why it's so sad we don't have Hermocrates' promised conversation. I also think Plato's giving a warning to the Athenians of his own day. He's writing this probably in the 360s because they're starting to get maritime imperialistic ambitions again. And he's saying, look, watch out. And at the end of the Critias, we hear, if you lust after money and power too much, you will end up destroying what, not only not getting any more, you will end up destroying what you've already got. And I've got an eccentric theory of my own for which I have no hard evidence, but I want to run it by you to see what you think. So in 367, Aristotle comes down from northern Greece to study at Plato's academy. Aristotle's father had been the court doctor at the court of the Macedonian kings. He was a great friend of Amyntas III, the father of Philip, grandfather of Alexander the Great. Aristotle would have known about Macedonian ambitions and the growth of Macedonian power. He might well have tipped Plato off about the danger now. It's not so much Sparta, look to the north, because Athens was very slow in seeing the threat from Macedonia. And I think Plato might have known about this. And I think he might also be giving a warning of, about empire. So it, for me, it's a powerful anti-imperialist story.
So are you suggesting that he's warning Athens needs to play again the marathonic role in fighting?
I think he's saying don't get any ideas about building an empire of your own, but also watch out.
Mind your back.
Exactly. You've got all these people making speeches about beware of Sparta, but look north, you're missing the main game.
Edith.
I am actually quite keen on talking a little bit more about sort of popular culture, because it really is one of the words, it's like the Odyssey, it's one of the four or five words from ancient Greek literature and philosophy that everybody in the world knows, but they do not know it's Plato. So if you go to Dubai, you can go to the most extraordinary thing called the Aqua Adventure Resort. It is enormous, and you can spend a whole week going to different bits of Atlantis. There's an aquarium part, there's a scuba diving part, there's a dining part, you can actually dine amidst the statues of Poseidon and so on. I think that there's a very important element of the pleasure of world building, right? And this is very important in computer games. There's a whole subset of computer games that depend on you creating your own world. So it's the modern equivalent of when we used to have farmyard sets and build our own big farmyard, right? You actually build your whole virtual world. And I have a child who's a very great expert in computer games and has shown me six where you actually build Atlantis or you actually get it back out of the sea again and you play survival games against other Atlanteans. So it's penetrated to a layer of popular culture that only the Odyssey and Aesop have.
Except in popular culture, how often is it recognised that Atlantis is actually the bad guy in the story? I mean, are we not being presented with this very materialistically rich, opulent culture as something to admire, which is exactly what Plato doesn't want?
Well, you think Plato doesn't want it. I do find that fascinating because it's a bit like, you know, Satan in Milton.
Okay.
I do think he gets so carried away with describing not this slightly boring inland hoplite army with very little pretty architecture and no bulls going around having their blood drunk. I think he actually does get carried away. And I think that's because he's competing with Homer. He's actually competing with Homer's Phaeacians there. And Plato does like to compete with Homer. You only have to read his Ion to see that he likes competing in a rhapsodic, descriptive way.
Yeah, I think that is one of the very interesting things about the Critias, is that it's not obvious it's not obvious that this is a bad state.
At first,
by implication, it is. But it's not. I mean, if you think of the comparison, say, with the Republic, and we have the four states: the monarchy, oligarchy, democracy, and tyranny. And it's very clear that all of them are highly defective. But if you just read the Critias, it's not on the surface. It's not spelled out in completely obvious ways that it is the baddie. So I think that's why we do get this, why history has fallen in love with Atlantis and not Athens. And also, I think that's why there is this sense of ambiguity about the truth status of the story. I think those two are hanged together.
Very quickly, Critias was said by later antiquity, had all his speeches, to be a great orator. So he may not have been a philosopher king, he was a sophist and an orator. So he shows off incredible verbal skills in those word portraits, and that would have been expected by anybody who had remembered Critias speaking in public.
Except, I mean, I agree with you, and I agree that Plato does really fall in love, part of him does fall in love with this state he's created, and his wonderful imaginative ability runs away. But before we even get any description of Atlantis, in the brief summary at the beginning of the Timaeus of the outline of Republic 2 to 5, which they've been discussing the day before, one of the few facts that's mentioned is that the guardians have no personal possessions or wealth or property and aren't allowed to go anywhere near gold or silver. So we've already had this very pure divorce of power than money. Quite an interesting idea. So one class has all the power, the other class has all the money. So we've already had that. So before we even start the description of Atlantis, Plato's already sowed in our minds the thought, do you know what? Actually, there's a little implicit criticism of its love, even before it degenerates. It's always in love with bling.
Yeah, no, I agree that if you're drenched in Plato, as soon as you read the Atlantis, you're going to see it's bad. But it's much less obvious and overt and upfront than you might have expected. That's okay.
There's another aspect to that in a writerly way, and I know I'm more of a literature person than a philosopher, but I've actually examined the tenses used in these two texts. And would you believe primordial Athens is almost all described in the imperfect tense and in the plural. So these unnamed people, they were farming, they were singing to the gods, they were doing this, that, and the next thing. They were forming an army. So it creates this timeless continuum. When it comes to Atlantis, it's all named individuals. We're given all these names, the son of so-and-so, the son of Atlas, and then Clito and Evander and all these people. And they're in the aorist. And then they did this. And then they did that. And then they did that. Now, that creates this very different world of a specific sort of analistic chronology that goes through time, which makes it much easier to identify with than these glorious people in this imperfect ideal world who just carried on doing it forever. So that's been very carefully done to create, as I say, a subjunctive world. In terms, I do think it's a sort of subjunctive, even though it's in the past.
Yes.
And this actually very specific, precise history of precise people, which is just like Herodotus.
Although it also fits in with the contrast I mentioned earlier about the contrast between stability and change.
Yes,
because
it does.
Because that Athens, ancient Athens, goes on and on doing the same thing, whereas
Like ancient Egypt.
Whereas in Atlantis, there's constant change and variation.
Growth. There's only one pluperfect in the whole of both of them. Uh-huh. And that is Athena and Hephaestus had been forever made the tutelary deities of Athens. Mm-hmm. It's the only one. Mm-hmm. And that implies, by using the pluperfect, both it was very, very, very long time ago, and it is now and forever will be. That's what happens with perfect tenses. They're perfective.
But only gods can have pluperfect.
Well, it's very funny. And in fact, Critias, at one point, I was talking about the undermining of the memory, says, when we were here yesterday, well, we weren't. We've been told we're not in Piraeus anymore. That was where we were yesterday as guests. We're now hosts back somewhere in Athens. Mm-hmm. And he actually forgets where he was. This is the guy whose memory we're relying on something that somebody said. And in fact, it's a chain of nine.
It's the Egyptian priest to Solon, to Dropides, and then to a father and a grandfather, to grandson. It is then said at a place, at a meal that Plato wasn't at. So one of the people at the meal will have had to tell Plato, we, as the readers of it, are number nine. It's well, the chain of nine.
Oh, no. Critias is, the young Critias's father is never mentioned. He says he heard it straight from his grandfather.
Yes, but his grandfather heard it from his father.
You missed that one. You're about to be interrupted by the producer, Simon Tillerson.
Would anyone like your coffee?
I can have a herbal
tea. Would you like to
No, I'd like a herbal tea, please.
A cup of tea if everyone wanted to have it.
Hi, Charlotte Williams.
And Amit Katwala here. We are here to tell you about All Consuming, our new podcast series from BBC Radio 4.
Where we'll be exploring our culture of consumption through products that have changed the world.
In each episode, we'll be looking back at the weird and wonderful history of an everyday product and unravelling the formidable forces that drive our purchasing habits.
We're looking at everything from vinyl...
It made you appreciate the music more.
...toilet paper...
And there's not a lot of panic going on. It's actually quite rational.
...and fragrances.
Our capability of being manipulated when it comes to scent is tremendous.
All that and a lot more.
So join us for All Consuming, a new series from Radio 4, available on BBC Sounds.
We hope to see you there.
Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Collider says BritBox has TV everyone should be watching. Stream acclaimed series with powerful performances from Jodie Whittaker, Tamara Lawrence, Bella Ramsey and Matthew McFadyen. Discover new BritBox original series you won't find anywhere else. Like Three Little Birds, Agatha Christie's Murder is Easy and a new chapter of BAFTA-winning drama, Time. Stream what the New York Times calls the best of British telly, only on BritBox. Start a free trial at BritBox.com.